Now, if you turn back to 1 Kings 19, and hopefully everybody can see the sermon notes, because it might be easier going through the sermon if you can't see them. Maybe you can share them out. I didn't know how many copies to do, but hopefully there aren't enough. So if a 3-point sermon takes about half an hour or 35 minutes, look at how long this one's going to take. Look at how many points are in it. Well, I'm trying to break the whole passage up. And just to start off here, when you think of the words, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, is that part of your life? Some days I think, I wonder, is it part of my life? Have I sometimes forgotten about the kingdom? Because it's so easy to do that. It's so easy to build your own little kingdoms in life, around your own life, around your own desires. And yet we are to pray, your kingdom come. And God has given us this privileged position of saying, yes, he will bring his kingdom. Yes, it's his power. But woven into that plan, he weaves the prayers of his people, that they will pray for the kingdom to come. And in response to those prayers, the kingdom will come. But as we look at First Kings 19, we're going to look at Elijah, whose life was so closely wrapped up with the kingdom that it really was inseparable. Now we're going to get to that, why I'm stressing that. Elijah's life was so closely wrapped up with the kingdom, in a sense, the two were inseparable. That's a really important point I'm starting out on this evening. And that's what we'll see in 1 Kings 19. And I'm going to say right from the start, I'm not going to interpret 1 Kings 19 in terms of Elijah being a bit depressed, and in a sense, the Bible teaching us about depression. With respect, I think that's not what the passage is about. I really changed my view on this passage just about 20 something years ago when I happened to start reading Lang's commentary. If any of you have a set of Lang's commentaries, they're written in the 1800s, at the end of the 1800s. Wonderful commentary on 1 Kings. And a brilliant commentary in the book of Job in that Lang set of commentaries. But it was just reading the Lang's commentaries that made you think, no, this passage actually isn't about personal depression. This passage is about the big picture. This passage is about the kingdom. This passage is about the grand scale of things through the life of one man, Elijah. And that's the whole thrust of this evening in 1 Kings 19, that we're going to look at this bigger picture. We're going to look at what it meant in the history of Israel, what it meant amongst the nations, and even what it means now. And so, when you look at verses 1 to 3, you have a familiar story. He's just been successful on Mount Carmel. There's been great victory. And in a sense, yes, Elijah does think that there will be success. But as it tells us there, when Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, how he had slain the prophets with the sword, well, Jezebel takes control. She threatens Elijah. And Elijah sees, oh, things really haven't changed the way I thought they might change. Things haven't changed anyway, the way I thought they would change. And so what does he do? He runs, it says, for his life. That's an important phrase. He arose and went for his life. He has a place to go. And he goes to Beersheba, and he leaves his servant there. And as I say in the notes there, just remember that. He flees for his life. Then look at verses 4 to 5. You see, I've just put in the notes there, I don't think it's really about spiritual depression here. And when many people read verse 4, they say, well, can you not see the man's depressed? And he sits down and he's tired and he requests for himself that he might die and said, it is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my father's. And sometimes people come to this and they say, there you go. He in a sense seemed to have thoughts akin to suicidal thoughts. He just wanted his life to end. But I don't think that is the main point of the chapter at all. What I would propose here is to understand that Elijah was so closely bound up with the nation of Israel. So closely bound up with it that the book of James tells you, and that's where I left off 20 years ago, okay, here in Loughbrickton. He was so closely bound up with the nation that he had been praying even before the drought came. He was praying for it to happen. Everything he lived for each day was all about the nation of Israel. And what has Elijah now witnessed? Elijah, in his own estimation, sees that Israel has surely come to an end. That Israel has surely come to an end, and the following verses bear that out. Because Elijah is what I would call, and I'm going to use the technical term, the covenant prosecutor. Elijah didn't make the laws or deliver the laws. Moses did. But Elijah was the head of the prophets because the prophets prosecuted the people. They told Israel down through the generations, you have broken the law. And what we're going to see in a moment or two is that Elijah's life is so inseparably wrapped up with Israel that he will go to Mount Sinai, we're going to read, and he wants God to bring it to an end. All of Israel's history, just bring it to an end. And so if his life is inseparably wrapped up with the nation of Israel, there is no purpose for him to live anymore. That's the context. And so it's not some bare thought, take away my life. It seems to be connected to Israel itself. It seems to be connected to what he's now going to do. Because as we'll see in a moment or two, he comes and he prosecutes Israel. And that's why he does it. But simply before we get to that, look at verses 6 to 8. Does that remind you of anything? That when he went for the wilderness and went on a journey and went 40 days and 40 nights onto Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, does that ring any bells in your thinking? Does that have an echo of something that happened earlier? Well, surely it does. Surely you remember then Israel wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. What's Elijah doing? He's reenacting the nation. He's reenacting the nation in its wilderness wanderings, but instead of coming from Sinai to Canaan, he's going back. The whole thing is in reverse. Now he wanders the 40 days and he goes back to Mount Sinai. He's acting out what Israel did. He is the prophet, the one man. But strangely, he's also the nation. The two are seen just joining together there in his own person. It's amazing when you go to Matthew 4 that you see something similar in the life of Jesus. Because you see Jesus in Matthew 4 being tested in the wilderness for 40 days. Amazingly, he is reenacting Israel in the wilderness once again. So the pattern was laid down by Elijah, and it was followed again in the person of Jesus. And the stunning difference with Jesus is, he is the Israel in the wilderness that does not fail. Israel had failed. Elijah going back to Sinai, it's all about failure. But when you come to Matthew 4, Jesus is the Israel in the wilderness, and it's not about failure. It's about passing the test. It's about doing things perfectly. Amazingly then, when you come to verses 9 to 10, did you notice the pattern? Did you notice the 3 and the 1? Because when you come to verses 9 and 10, and he came thither unto a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said unto him, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" Do you remember? "I have been very zealous for the Lord of God of hosts. For the children of Israel have," and then here's the list, "firstly, forsaken thy covenant. Secondly, thrown down thine altars. Thirdly, slain thy prophets with the sword." See the 3 complaints. And then there's one corresponding little phrase at the end. "And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life." Get that phrase again. "They seek my life to take it away." He's bringing this charge against Israel. He's bringing these charges against Israel. And where is he bringing these charges against Israel? He's bringing the charges against Israel at Sinai. The law was delivered at Sinai. It was given to Israel at Sinai. And now here is the covenant prosecutor. Here is the prosecutor bringing Israel before God at Sinai. And in a sense, it seems it's all over. I alone am left. There is no one else. The whole thing with Israel coming from Sinai and going to Canaan, it's over in Elijah's mind. It can be no more. And that's why very strongly I understand his life itself was wrapped up with Israel's good and Israel's existence. And so he comes back to prosecute Israel at the very place Israel had been given the law. And then look how God speaks to him. And when you look at verses 11 and 12, do you get the pattern again? Do you get the pattern of the 3 and the 1? 3 specific charges and 1 I alone am left. And then how does God speak to him? He speaks corresponding to the complaint, the 3 and the 1. "And the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire." There are the 3. And then the 1 on its own. "And after the fire, a still small voice." But the penny hasn't dropped with Elijah. He can't understand God's message by way of sign. He has to have it spelled out. He can't understand what these signs are about, the 3 and the 1. And so when God speaks to him again, and it says, "And so it was when Elijah heard it Then he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, What doest thou here, Elijah? And what does he say? It's exactly the same charges over again. The three charges: they have forsaken thy covenant. They've thrown down thine altars. They've slain thy prophets with the sword. The three. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. God had been speaking in signs. And when Elijah had heard the signs or witnessed the signs, he couldn't understand it. And now in verses 13 to 18, God spells the signs out. The three and the one. And amazingly, those three signs and the three things God tells Elijah to do, they correspond to the three charges and the one. Because as you read through them, just look at how carefully the whole thing is structured. Go return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. Jehu the son of Nimshi, anoint him to be king over Israel. And Elisha, anoint him to be the prophet who comes after you. And God spells it out. What are these three for? Well, they're like the three signs, the terrible signs on the mountain, back in those verses 11 and 12, when it says the wind and the earthquake and then the fire. And those three correspond to God bringing judgment on the nation of Israel. And it's as if God is saying to Elijah, do you not realize I know everything that has been going on in Israel? I know everything, and I have a plan, and I will bring judgment. And there is judgment yet to come, and it will come through Hazael. It will come through Jehu. It will come even through Elisha. Justice will come to Israel. That will have its time. But then amazingly, look at verse 18. But not only will justice come, but grace will come. Mercy will come. And amazingly, he says, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel. Now, what does that correspond to in Elijah's complaint? I alone am left. They seek to take my life. I alone am left. Finish it, God. Israel's over. There's no point in carrying on. And amazingly, what happens in verse 18? No, Elisha, you haven't even got that right. You haven't even got that right. Because I have the remnant. I have worked in people's hearts. I have left me 7,000 in Israel. All the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. What an amazing reply to Elijah's complaints. What an amazing reply to the charges Elijah brought at Sinai. Elijah had thought everything was finished. He had thought things were so bad in Israel, it could never ever work, because he alone was left and God must wipe them all out. His own life was tied up with that. Everything's over in Elijah's mind. But Elijah sees then what God is saying. Elijah sees that he had missed all this out. He had missed all out that God really would bring justice in Israel. That God really would work amongst the nations, Syria and Israel, and work within Israel and work within the nations to bring his justice to the whole situation. Yet he only wouldn't work in justice. He wouldn't bring his justice. He would show his mercy. What an amazing thing. Because again, that corresponds with that sound of gentle stillness, or we might know as the still, small voice. God is the God of justice. God will bring his justice. There is a time for that. But God is the God of mercy. God is the one who opens people's hearts and gives them the ability not to bow the knee to Baal. He gives them the ability to believe the promises given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Justice would come, but Elijah also had to see mercy. Now we're at the very final point in the sermon. And as you think of these things, how do you really stand back from that whole story about Elijah? And hopefully you can see at least my argument here, why it's a lot more complex than Elijah feeling a bit down and God sparking him up a bit or something like that. That sells a lot of the detail out. It really doesn't deal with it. But we've got to see an amazing thing taking place here. We've got to see this pattern being laid down about the one man and the nation. And many times you see that throughout the whole of the Old Testament. That the one man is identified with the nation. And interestingly, that's often a way to read and sing the Psalms. Read and sing the Psalms on many levels. But think of it as the original Jewish faithful person singing to God. But sometimes the I and the me who's doing the suffering isn't on a personal level. It's on a national level. And yet represented with the words I and me. And then as the nation suffers, it ultimately narrows down to one man suffering, Jesus himself. And that's what I would say goes on here in this passage. You see one man so closely linked to the nation. He thinks he's the only one left. He represents the nation. He wanders 40 days back to Mount Sinai. And amazingly it sets the pattern. Because as you read through the book of Isaiah, do you know those passages that even nowadays Jewish people say, well, those passages are speaking about the suffering of the nation. How can you apply them to the suffering of a person? And so right up to chapter 49, there are many passages which are in dispute. They say it's only the nations being referred to there. I think there's a big change in Isaiah 49. There's God sends another servant to redeem the first servant, which seems to be the nation. But in any case, can you see it? The servant, one person. The servant can also be the nation. And then when you come to the book of Matthew, do you remember even in the very birth of Christ, when they have to take refuge in Egypt, and when God says, out of Egypt I have called my son. And that's a verse from Hosea 11 verse 1. I haven't put that in the notes. That's a verse from Hosea 11 verse 1 which refers to the nation of Israel. And how is it spoken of in Matthew? It's spoken of in terms of the person of Jesus. And so this pattern is laid down in the Old Testament. It's seen with the suffering prophet, Elijah. It's seen with the servant in the book of Isaiah. And it is then fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. Because ultimately Jesus Christ is the prophet and the servant who brings all the promises of God to fulfillment. In him all the promises are yes and amen. And then look on down here to the third little subpoint here. You see, what God was doing on Mount Sinai that day Elijah was there. He was telling Elijah, everything's on course, Elijah. You think it's all over? You are despairing? Your life's so closely wrapped up with the nation, you see no point in going on because you think the nation's finished. But no, everything is going according to my plan. I have planned all of these things. And amazingly, I am working my plan, my kingdom, my way. And that amazing picture of the remnant appears in 1 Kings 19. You know, when you read Romans 11, 1 to 10, Paul doesn't bring out the fact that Elijah was a bit depressed. What does he bring out of the whole story? He brings out exactly that God works through a remnant. And when Paul struggles, and you read Romans 9, 10 and 11, and he struggles that his own countrymen are not believing in Jesus of Nazareth, and he struggles with it so bitterly in those chapters, and yet he takes consolation in the fact that it had happened before. The pattern was laid down, and God was still saving a remnant in Israel. I think I think that's where the footnote is, because the very final thing I want to say, this chapter isn't just to remind Elijah and to remind Paul that everything's on course. It's to remind us as well this evening that everything's on course in God's plan. And even those very details, as I've already said, sometimes we get so disheartened when we hear Christians interviewed on TV or the radio, and it just seems sometimes, does no one say anything right? It seems to be such a mess. And yet, what has God done before the nations? And I would argue on the basis of Romans 9, 10 and 11, and this was something we went through with our GO team just a couple of weeks ago in Uri, that you have to really understand that. That the assumption Paul makes in those chapters is that the nations will be able to identify the descendants of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob until the end of time. And that they will be able to see that for most of that time, most of Israel will not believe that the Messiah is Jesus of Nazareth. Are those things verifiable? Of course they are. They're taking place in front of the nations. God still has his remnant of Jews, and Gentiles are being brought in. Everything is on course. Everything is on course, and therefore we don't need to be frustrated. We don't need to be frustrated, but that doesn't mean we sit back. You see, Elijah, when he realized he didn't need to be frustrated, he simply had to go and do what God had told him. And what has God told us to do? He hasn't told us to go and anoint people. He's told us simply to keep on praying, your kingdom come. The very first phrase we started off with in the notes there. He's told us to simply keep heralding the gospel to the nations, declaring faithfully that Jesus Christ is King. Amen.